working our way through this example, and we talked about using different features as discriminators. And we talked about looking at the properties of two features, both width and lightness, and the fact that since there's information, since these features potentially complement each other, we can look at their properties together doing a scatter plot. And when you look at this data, you might decide, well, it would be a reasonable thing to do to draw a line here and decide if any point is to the left, lower left of that line, that the class is salmon, and if any point is to the right of that line, the class is seabass. So that's our first example of what's called a decision surface. And in this particular case, you could actually use a regression analysis to produce the coordinates of that line. Throughout the semester, we'll discuss much more sophisticated ways to make that determination. Now, you might ask, well, can we do better than a linear classifier? We could draw a very complicated surface based on the individual properties of these data points. But what's the major problem with that approach? I mean, this would give us 0% error on this particular data set. Or for a data set. And we call that the generalization problem. And generally, as we'll see throughout the semester, one of the ways we deal with that problem is to try to find decision surfaces that have a fairly low dimensionality. So it might make sense to actually smooth this surface somewhat to get a better decision surface so that it has better generalization properties. That's based on a principle called Occam's razor, which we'll talk about later in the semester. So there we show an example of how you might actually smooth that line. Now, you might argue, well, that surface will give you a better performance than a linear surface, but might still have good generalization properties. And we'll discuss many different techniques to find these kinds of surfaces. Separating data in feature spaces, that's essentially what this class is all about. That can be really easy in the case where you have well-separated classes, or it can be very difficult in the case where you have more complicated classes. We'll use throughout the semester this pattern recognition applet that we have that lets you test some of these principles on some data that you can make up, or you can use some preloaded data. But one of the things we'll see throughout the semester is that the best type of classifier to use for a problem really depends to a large extent on how the data itself is distributed. So in this case, we have actually this data was generated from two Gaussian distributions. It's fairly well separated, and we can see that any kind of a surface in this region where there's no data would give us a pretty good performance. In this case, the data is spherically distributed, so there's no directionality, if you will, to the data. Here we have a data set, though, where there's very clear differences in variance in different directions. The correlation structure of this second data is more complicated. This is actually also data generated from two Gaussian distributions, but the covariance structure of those Gaussian distributions are not uniform, and we'll talk about that in more detail in a couple lectures. Here we have a case which is interesting because the direction we've got both classes have a certain amount of variance in the same direction, but the direction of discrimination is the direction in which each of the classes has minimum variance. And we'll talk about classifiers that are designed to deal with this. And then here we have an example of a data set like the one we saw previously where the data cannot be separated using a linear surface. We need to use some kind of nonlinear surface to separate this data. And we'll talk about techniques that can, in fact, separate that kind of data. Now, and then as we talked about it in last lecture, real data is often much harder. Real data this is some data collected from some audio data. And real data has, in the feature space, typically has a lot of overlap, very complicated relationships between the classes, and that's why we need to go to very powerful algorithms that can make use of domain knowledge and also build very sophisticated decision surfaces. So, what I like to call the first principle of pattern recognition, there's many excellent resources on the internet to demonstrate pattern recognition concepts. This is one of the applets that we've developed here at Mississippi State that we'll use. There's a lot of different MATLAB toolboxes. There's a lot of Java code and other things. But there's thousands or tens of thousands of algorithms and approaches. So an important first principle is that there's no magic equations or algorithms. You must understand the properties of your data and what a priori knowledge you can bring to bear on the problem. It's very difficult to argue that one algorithm is better than another. In a field like this, it's very common that when somebody comes up with a new algorithm, for example, when neural networks were introduced in the 80s or when support vector machines became popular in the 90s, when Bayesian techniques became popular in the early 2000s, there's a tendency, everybody publishes these algorithms. Everybody publishes this algorithm applied to their data and tries to proclaim that this is the best algorithm yet. And that's not really the case. There's no algorithm that's better or worse than any other algorithm. It really comes down to how that algorithm performs on your particular data set and whether the assumptions behind that algorithm are relevant to your problem. Very often, and I see this over and over, when somebody publishes a result that says this new algorithm is better than some previous algorithm, it's very often not the algorithm that's making the difference, but it's the assumptions or the knowledge that they're applying to the problem that's making the difference. So you have to be very, very careful when you do algorithm comparisons to make sure that each algorithm it has access to the same type of information. So one of the things you will not walk away from this class with is the idea that a particular algorithm is the best algorithm for all applications. In fact, you walk away from this class with the reverse. You walk away from this class realizing there's thousands of algorithms out there. How do I pick the right one for my problem? And therefore, we're going to spend more time talking about the problem itself and the assumptions you make about the problem than we are going to spend talking about specific algorithms, because the algorithms are not really as important as issues like, are you making use of prior probabilities and how are you estimating these prior probabilities and things like that. So what pattern recognition really is all about is trying to incorporate as much knowledge about the problem as possible into your decision surface. Now, I have a little animation here that discusses the problem of generalization. Another very fundamental problem to pattern recognition is it's easy to demonstrate a result like improved performance on a particular data set, but it's very difficult to demonstrate better performance across a wide variety of problems. So this sort of can be boiled down to a question of how much do you trust isolated data points? And we'll go through the animation and then I'll sort of talk about the implications of that. So here we have two data points. Now, if I asked you to classify these data points, what type of classifier would you use? And what by classify we mean, we haven't defined that formally yet, but here you have two colors, each color belongs to a different class. So this is class one, this is class two. I show you those two data points, and I ask you, build a classifier that classifies this data. What classifier would you choose? Okay, well, there's many linear classifiers you could choose. Which one in particular would you choose? A straight diagonal between them, like this? You would, exactly. You'd probably draw a line between the two points and then draw something perpendicular to those lines. Now, you're saying, well, that's really stupid, but if you think about that, this is what people do all the time. One of the examples I like to cite are children. As you watch children learn. If you show a child, for example, you show a child a person and a dog, and you, a very young child, you know, like 1 year old or 2 years old, when they look at a person and a dog, they'll make, and you explain to them, this is a person, this is a dog, what typically will a child learn from that? Well, what they'll learn from that is that people have two legs and animals have four legs. So then you show them a donkey, and they look at the donkey, and they'll say, oh, that's a dog. And then you have to explain, well, no, that's not a dog. So children, as they learn, are very, very much trusting of the data that they're given. And only through instruction do they learn to sort of generalize. It's very interesting as you watch children learn how much, in fact, they will overgeneralize on problems. That's one of the ways humans learn. So we have these two data points. We all agree, you know, that's a good decision surface. So we get two more data points. Okay, so what now, what conclusion do we draw? Are we happy? Yeah, we're happy. Why? I mean, we're not totally happy, but we're, relatively speaking, we're happy. Why? When we saw these next two data points, what happened? And I mean, this isn't a trick question. It's just stating the obvious. We got the original two data points. We drew a decision surface. We were worried about generalization. These next two data points were introduced. And what, how would you describe what happened, what the result is? Is our decision surface still valid? Okay. It's impossible to draw a straight line to separate those two points. How might we separate those two points? I mean, how might we, you know, give, if this is the data, what kind of decision surface would we require? So that's a little hard, that's a harder question. Because now when you see this data, you start to think, what is additional data going to look like? So now, that's actually not correct because I switched the colors. But so now we get these two additional data points. Now what happens? So when we had these, when we had these two points, what are some of the decision surfaces you might consider? Well, one that you might consider is something like this, right? You could build sort of two sets of lines or two surfaces. And now with these surfaces, we've got an even much more complicated problem because you've got one data set here and another data set here. So you'd have to think about how you might build a decision surface. Well, there's one possible decision surface. Now, what the real issue here is that as we started with two data points, we had a decision surface. As we added data points, the decision surface started to change dramatically. So that's a real problem because that tells us that either we don't have enough data or that we don't really understand the assumptions of the problem. Because you generally would like your decision surfaces to be roughly constant or stable as you move from data point to data point. So this kind of a situation, I think there's one more. This kind of a situation demonstrates that we have a real problem with how much trust we place on each and every data point. Because if we start modifying the decision surface based on every data point, we can end up with decision surfaces which are far too specific to the actual data that we're looking at. On the other hand, if we try to generalize and still stick with this line classifier, we're going to have a fairly high error rate. Now, in this course, we will develop techniques that can give you 0% classification error on problems like this. It is no problem to build classifiers that can drive error rates to zero on a particular data set. The problem is making sure that that classifier is general enough that it handles all data sets from that problem space. And this is going to be a recurring problem with most of the algorithms that we look at. Now, if you are faced with data like this, one of the things that we try to do is to integrate prior knowledge about the data. If we're concerned about the trust that we place in data points, we can also introduce the concept of confidence. We can actually introduce confidence measures with each data point to sort of somehow weight how much trust we want to give to the data points. It could be, for example, that these two data points were actually just mislabeled by in our database. In real problems like speech recognition, it's not uncommon that 1 or 2 or 5% of your data is actually mislabeled. And you must develop training techniques that are robust to mislabeled data. And this is a real issue, especially with algorithms that can drive error rates to zero, because they will learn based on the labeling errors. And teaching algorithms to be robust to labeling errors in the data is a very important part of the pattern recognition problem that you won't often see discussed in the textbooks, because it's a very messy, it's not a problem that lends itself to mathematical analysis, but it's a very real problem. And if you're working with any large data set, some percentage of that data is going to be mislabeled. And if your classifier starts learning that mislabeled data, you have a real problem. So very often we try to do things like confidence measures to try to detect whether we have high confidence in the data or not. And we'll show throughout the semester some techniques where we can do that, looking at things like likelihoods or probabilities. Another thing that we often will couple into this is the concept of risk. And we'll talk a little bit about risk in the next lecture. The idea really is, how much risk do you want to take when you're building a classifier? This is an idea that's very common in some non-engineering disciplines like the insurance industry. The insurance industry is all about managing risk. When they charge you a certain amount of money for insurance, there's a risk built into that assessment. They do a classification. They look at your property or your car or whatever, but they don't just look at that. They also look at a lot of the issues like what area you live in, what your history is and all that. And then they take a risk. In insuring you, they take a risk. They say, we want to run at a 90% risk or an 80% risk or 70% risk. Gambling is another good example of situations where your decisions are based on risk. In gambling, for example, if you gamble on sporting events, you not only worry about who's going to win or who's going to lose, but sort of the problem, how confident you are about that choice. And then you assign margins, what they often call point spreads and things, to sort of manage that. And it turns out with sophisticated gamblers, it's not so much about picking who's going to win or lose, it's about beating the point spread. Because this point spread is essentially what controls your risk. Now, we're going to we'll talk more extensively today about the Bayesian formulation for pattern recognition. I just wanted to introduce an example of that today in the context of speech recognition. This is where a lot of the Bayesian applications in pattern recognition began. In the speech recognition problem, we try to formulate the problem of one human communicating a message to another human. We try to formulate that as what's called a noisy communications channel model. You have some message in your mind, intended in your brain, if you will. And if you translate that message to words, you then translate that message to articulatory movements. And then eventually what comes out is some signal. the listener then receives that signal and sort of goes through the inverse process and ultimately receives some message. And if the system has worked well, the message that the listener hears is the same message that you intended. Now, as we all know, in real life, what you're thinking is not what the listener is hearing. And therefore, a good model for that is that we model this as a noisy communication process where each one of these blocks introduces some amount of error. And we can then model the overall process as a probability of being correct, and we can then develop a very nice model of how we can maximize the probability of being correct given the data and such. This is essentially what's known as the Bayesian formulation for speech recognition. In this particular case, what we do is we model the probability of the words that you intended or the words you spoke given the features that we measure. We call that the probability of the words given the acoustics. Through Bayes' rule, we can model that as the probability of the acoustics given the words times the probability of words times the probability of the acoustics. Our approach is to maximize this probability during training, and that probability and this whole equation involves the probability of the acoustics given the words, which we call the acoustic model, and we'll talk this semester about ways to do that using things like hidden Markov models, Gaussian mixtures, and such. Times the probability of the words, that's often called a language model, and if you take a course in computational linguistics or something related to natural language processing, you'll learn about techniques like finite state machines, n-gram models, and such that allow you to model this. This essentially takes into account the prior probabilities of the words that you spoke, so that if a word is more probable to occur, we will weight that more heavily in the computation. And then this is divided by the probability of the acoustics, and we tend to ignore that during maximization. Now, in a few minutes, I'll go through this in a more formal way. But the point here is that Bayes' rule allows us to convert the problem of estimating an unknown posterior probability, that's what we call this P of W given A, to a process in which we can postulate a model, collect data under controlled conditions, and estimate the parameters of the model. And that, in a nutshell, is how we do pattern recognition. We collect some data, train a model, and then evaluate the model. Okay, so what we've covered in this first lecture are pattern recognition versus machine learning versus machine understanding. We talked about the first principle of pattern recognition, and we'll focus more on decision theory and less on feature extraction. So let me now go to the next lecture where we'll talk more specifically about Bayes' rule. And what today we'll probably make it through about half of this lecture. So now what we're going to talk about, we're going to begin chapter 2. Chapter 2 and chapter 3 are essentially the entire course. What we'll do is we'll spend a lot of time going through Chapter 2 and Chapter 3, and then the rest of the course will be really devoted to applications of Chapter 2 and Chapter 3. So we'll begin Chapter 2 today, and Chapter 2 essentially deals with Bayesian decision theory. So let's first talk about the general concept of probability decision theory. Bayesian decision theory is a fundamental statistical approach to the problem of pattern classification. Bayesian techniques date back to the mid-1800s. They've been around for a long time in various forms, but they really came to fruition in the 90s. And that's where a lot of the theory was really became well understood. And in this decade, you know, we're almost at the end of the 2000 decade, and you probably, as you look through literature, you'll see just about every application area now uses Bayesian techniques in one form or another. So they've been very popular, very successful. They're not perfect. They don't solve every problem. In fact, I think it's very clear that the Bayesian model we're about to discuss isn't necessarily a good model for how things behave in the real world, but it's the best model that we have to date. Now, what it allows us to do is to quantify the trade-offs between various classification decisions using probability and the costs that accompany these decisions. So really, it's the Bayesian technique is not so much an algorithm, but it's a methodology where we can very nicely trade off knowledge about different aspects of the problem, and it can, and then we can apply particular algorithms to each one of those components to build our overall model. So it's sort of a framework in which we can do pattern recognition. We're going to begin by assuming all relevant probability distributions are known. Now later we will learn how to estimate these from the data. That's essentially what chapter 3 is all about. In chapter 2, we're going to assume we know the relevant probability distributions, and we're going to focus on the question of how do we actually make classification decisions knowing these probability distributions. Now that's very much artificial, because in real problems you never know these probability distributions. But what we'll do in chapter 3 is we'll show you how to estimate these probability distributions from the data, and then we'll have essentially the ability to take data and build classifiers and do classification. Now you're going to struggle, typically in this course the students struggle with the difference between chapter 2 and chapter 3. So I'm going to keep hitting on this lecture after lecture. 2 is about classification, 3 is about training or parameter estimation. And it turns out we can use Bayesian techniques for both. So it's going to get really confusing, because you'll be a little bit confused. Is he talking about a Bayesian classifier, or is he talking about a Bayesian technique to estimate the parameters of the classifier? And what all these techniques are ultimately about is how we exploit prior knowledge. So in the context of our fish classification example, you might ask, are the sequence of fish predictable? That's something that we can apply statistical models to determine. Is each class equally probable? Are bass and salmon equally probable? Well, it turns out they aren't, and we can exploit that information. That's a problem in what we call prior probabilities, and if we assume each class is equally probable, that's what we call uniform priors, and we'll see the implications of that shortly. But another really important question that impacts the type of classifier we'll use is, what is the cost of an error? And that's a topic that we often call risk. In some applications, errors can be very fatal. In some applications, errors can be not so fatal. For example, when you're building a telephone answering system, and you ask somebody to speak a choice, say 1 if you want operator, say 2 if you want service, whatever. In applications like that, you may be very concerned that you do not want to send a customer to the wrong choice. Sending the customer to a wrong choice might be very fatal. So what you will do is bias the system so that it will only send a customer to an alternative if you're very, very sure that that's correct. If not, you'll bounce the person to an operator. You may have experienced some of this. In applications that are much more serious, I've done a lot of work in the military space. In the military space, you face this all the time. Sometimes these kinds of classification decisions can be the difference between life or death. If you ever think about, if you look at what's going on in the world and you see missiles being fired from unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs and things, and you wonder about this, well, the people who do that kind of work have to worry about the costs of an error or risk, because they're firing these missiles, these weapons, on very incomplete information, and therefore they build into their assessment these kinds of concerns that it's very important that they be very sure when they take an action. In other situations, you may tolerate very high error rates. If you look at the way closed captioning systems work on television, and you look at the transcripts that they output, some of these are now computer generated. And you look at those and you say, well, when it makes an error here or there, I don't really care. It's not the end of the world. So those kinds of systems do not penalize errors as much. But the point is that this question is very important to building the optimal classification system. There's no right or wrong system for an application. Very often when a customer comes to you with a problem, they will not really know what the cost of an error is. That's something you as an engineer are going to have to determine by talking to the customer, understanding the application. And that's why we tend to look at the performance of systems with what's called a ROC or receiver operator characteristic. We look at the performance not as a single point, but as a function of this trade-off between misclassifications and what's often called false alarms and false rejects. Because it's not really the case that when two systems give you different performance, it may just be that they're biased slightly differently in terms of the cost of an error. And what's important is to show that these systems are different across a range of operating conditions. And we'll talk about this in a formal way in a few classes. Now, prior probabilities that play a very, very important part in Bayesian analysis. And this is something that you probably haven't thought much about prior to this course. If you remember, I like to use your entry-level physics laboratories. I think they still do these kinds of things. But if you remember in physics or chemistry lab, when you were doing a lab to prove some kind of formula or some kind of theorem, like force is equal to mass times acceleration, you'd collect a lot of data points and you'd plot them on a piece of graph paper, and then you draw a line through those data points, right? And what invariably happened in those laboratories when you looked at your real data? There's what? There's always one or two data points where you say, what was I doing when I measured that data point? Because that data point can't obviously be right. That's an assessment about prior probabilities. You realize that that data point doesn't fit the same assumption, the same equation that all the other data points do, and you sort of throw it out saying, well, that must be an anomalous piece of data. So that's one example of how we use this. A more interesting example of this is a situation where you have a two-way choice, but one of the choices is much more probable than the other. So an example of this trying to think of a good current example of this. We might talk about the presidential election. Towards the end, it was clear Obama was going to win by a landslide, right? So if someone asked you, you know, who's going to win the election, you could toss a coin to answer that question because it's a two-way choice, right? And if you tossed a coin, what would be your chance of being correct? 50%, right? But with prior knowledge, you know that there's a very high probability Obama was going to win that. So if you consistently chose Obama, you would, on the average, do much better than tossing a coin. That's not the best example, but in the case of the sea bass and salmon, if you're catching fish in Alaska during the time when salmon migrate, the number of bass is going to be very small. Now, you as a graduate student might go ahead and build this classifier and say, well, look, my classifier gets 33% error. That's really good. Give me my PhD. And that's about the time when I stand up at your defense and say, but wait a second. Salmon are 9 times more probable than bass. So if you just chose salmon all of the time with no research, no money, no graduate studies, you would be correct 9 out of 10 times. Now, you're laughing at this, but I have actually seen this even with my own students. The first classifiers we built on that scenic beauty problem I talked about last class, the first classifiers were worse than what I could have done if I just always made the most probable choice, a priori choice. And when I showed this to my students, they got really depressed because they've been working for months on the algorithm. But the prior probabilities are very important. So the prior probability is what we often call a state of nature, and that's prior information. We model that as a random variable omega. So omega we're going to use this semester as the to indicate the class, the class associated with a piece of data. Omega equals omega 1 is the event that the next fish is a sea bass. Omega equals omega 2 is the event that the next fish is a salmon. So category 1 is sea bass, category 2 is salmon, and we're going to call capital P of omega 1, the probability of category 1, capital P of omega 2 is the probability of category 2. And we'll have the constraint that P of omega 1 plus P of omega 2 is equal to 1. These probabilities behave a certain set of assumptions. One is what we call exclusivity, which says that omega 1 and omega 2 share no basic events. If something is in omega 1, it's not in omega 2. Now, that's actually, we will later in the semester learn how to build what are called soft classifiers that sort of violate this assumption. But for now, we're going to assume that data has to be in one class or the other. Now, it turns out that's not necessarily true. For example, if we use election as an example, it used to be that I come from Chicago, and people used to vote. We used to be very famous in Chicago that the city of Chicago was a Democratic city, and it was run by a very powerful, very smart mayor who did all sorts of things to make sure that Democrats would win every year. And one of the famous things that they did is they had a button on the polling machine that said "Vote Democratic for everything." And this was famous in Chicago, because when they would teach people, particularly we used to joke about little old ladies, you know, they take these old people into the voting booth and they would teach them how to vote. And how would they be teaching them how to vote? They would tell them, just press this button and everything will be taken care of. Now, that worked in the old days because everyone in Chicago was either a Democrat or you weren't. But today, what's happened with elections? Are people simply a Democrat or a Republican? How many people identify themselves as being totally Democrat or totally Republican? A much smaller percentage today. Most people vote sort of across, you know, they vote based on each candidate. They'll have a tendency, like they'll be mostly Democratic, but very few people today identify themselves as purely Democratic or purely Republican. So there's an example of where this model doesn't really fit. But nevertheless, we can still use this model for such problems. And if all incorrect classifications have an equal cost, we can decide that omega 1, the class omega 1, if P of omega 1 is greater than P of omega 2. Otherwise, we decide omega 2. So this is a simple decision rule that's based solely on prior probability. So this is the first classifier that you've actually learned in this course. Very simple classifier, and just says vote with whatever is the most probable class, and it's assuming that, you know, both classes are equally probable and that errors have equal costs and those kinds of things. We'll relax those assumptions shortly. But it actually turns out this is not a bad thing to do, because these priors are based on the way the world really is. They're based on the state of nature. So over the long haul, this may actually not be a bad thing to do. In fact, Las Vegas or a casino, and we'll talk about gambling throughout the semester, is basically built on this principle. The games are designed based on prior probability. And when you're gambling, all you're really trying to do is what they call beat the house. You're trying to essentially beat these prior probabilities. And that's why over the long haul, you will never win at a casino. You will eventually lose. Gambling is designed so that you will eventually lose. And people don't understand this, and it's hilarious because, you know, and what is a casino's main strategy when you gamble? It's to keep you there as long as possible. Because the longer you're there, the more you're going to lose. So we'll talk about this. Gambling is a really interesting application of a lot of this kind of thing. I don't know last time I taught the course, the movie 21 was coming out, which is a really interesting movie about some strategies you can do in blackjack to actually win consistently. And the way that you win at gambling is essentially very much based on pattern recognition concepts. You try to count cards, you try to have good prior information so that you can bet on the next card more intelligently than what the house is doing, which is essentially based on prior probabilities. Okay, so priors are pretty simple. Now, conditional probabilities are a little more complicated, but they're a very important part of what we do. So we're going to introduce conditional probabilities now. So a decision rule with only prior information always produces the same result, and it ignores measurements. So it can't really adapt to things. Like in a gambling scenario, as cards are being exposed to you from the deck, you're learning a little bit more about what cards are available, what cards aren't available, and therefore your knowledge is changing and you can do better than for example, blackjack, you can there's some basic rules in blackjack, like don't bet if you get 17 or higher, don't ask for another card. Well, these are based on no prior information. But if you're able to count cards and keep track of what's happening at the table at that particular moment, you can then change those decisions to be a little bit better. And that's essentially what class conditional probabilities are all about. So if P of omega 1 is much, much greater than P of omega 2, we will be correct most of the time. Our probability of error is going to be the minimum of P of omega 1 and P of omega 2. In other words, if we build a machine that always guesses based on the prior, our error rate is essentially going to be the smaller of the two prior probabilities, because we're always going to be betting on the larger of the prior probabilities. But we would like to think that we can do a little bit better than that. So given a feature X, which we can say is lightness, for example, which is a continuous random variable, P of X given omega 2 is the class conditional probability density function. And that's what we're showing an example of that to the right. So if lightness is class 2 and width is class 1, we can define two conditional probabilities, the probability of a measurement given omega 1 and the probability of a measurement given omega 2. So P of X given omega 1 and P of X given omega 2 describe the difference in lightness between populations of sea and salmon. So we have these two probability distributions, and you can see that they somewhat overlap in the sense of they tell us that our measurements, there's a certain error associated with our measurements because the same value of X has some probability of being associated with class omega 1 and class omega 2. This is just another way to look at those scatter plots that I showed you where you saw that the data overlapped. This simply says that there's always some probability that a feature can be assigned to any class. And in the real world, that's sort of the way it is, because you rarely have features that perfectly separate your classes. Your features are always have some kind of inherent confusability. Now, this is still a probability, so if you integrate that curve, it still integrates to 1 and that kind of thing. But it's conditioned on the class assignment. We're going to make use of these probabilities today pretty extensively. So probability density function is denoted in lowercase, and it represents a function of a continuous variable. You sometimes will see this as written as P sub X, but we often abbreviate that as P of X, dropping the subscript. And this denotes a probability density function for the random variable capital X. And the P of X given omega and P of Y given omega can be two completely different functions. It's still a probability. So as I said, we have the properties that its value is greater than or equal to 0, and it must sum or integrate to 1. Probability mass functions are typically used for discrete random variables, while densities describe continuous random variables. So with discrete random variables, we will write the sum of the probability is equal to 1, whereas with continuous random variables, we'll write the integral. Now, the other thing that's sort of here that I need to emphasize is that with discrete random variables, we write capital P because it's a probability mass function. It's not a density. It's defined only at a discrete set of points. With continuous random variables, we will write lowercase p because it's a true density function. So we have to pay a little bit of attention to that, but that's just a notational convention that follows from trying to be consistent with mathematical literature, which typically shows continuous functions as a lowercase variable and probabilities as a uppercase variable. And it'll get a little more complicated because there are times when we'll be dealing with continuous random variables, but we'll be also dealing with discrete density functions and such. And we'll just try to be careful and point that out as it arises. So let's talk now about Bayes' rule, which is probably the most important thing that we'll cover this semester. So suppose we know both the prior probability, capital P of omega sub j, and the density P of x given omega sub j. And we can measure x. X is just our features. How does this influence our decision? Well, the joint probability of finding a pattern that is in category j and that this pattern has a feature value of x, we're going to write that as small p of omega sub j comma x. That's the joint probability. And that can be written in terms of the marginal probabilities as p of omega sub j given x times p of x. Or p of x given omega sub j times p of omega sub j. This is just, you may remember this from probability theory. It's just writing a joint probability in terms of a conditional probability and a marginal probability. Now, we can rearrange terms in this equation and arrive at what's known as Bayes' formula, which says that P of omega sub j given x is equal to P of x given omega sub j times P of omega sub j over P of x. And in the case of our two-category classification problem, this P of x is just the sum over both classes of P of x given omega sub j times P of omega sub j. Now, this equation is rather remarkable because what it tells us is it says that the probability of choosing a class based on the data is equal to the probability of the data given the class times the probability of the class divided by the probability of the data. And we'll expand on that this semester, but right now I'd like you to think about the fact that if I give you a vector and I ask you what's the class associated with the vector, that's a classification problem. But if I give you a class and I ask you to what's the probability that you observed a particular vector, that's a training problem. That's equivalent to the difference between I can ask you to say a word, and then I can measure the signal that results. That's P of X given omega sub J. Or I can ask you to, here's a audio signal, tell me what word was spoken. That's P of omega sub J given X. So this equation allows us to actually train classifiers because it tells us how to relate the classifier to the training data that we can collect. So I think we'll stop here, and we'll pick this up next time. But Bayes' formulation is really where we begin the pattern recognition problem because it shows us how to relate classifiers to training data. Okay, so we will continue on Monday.